Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The global population is expected to reach 8 billion by mid-November, and India is projected to overtake China as the world's most populated country in 2023, the UN said on Monday. The finding comes in the latest World Population Prospects Report issued on World Population Day, observed annually on the 11th of July. UN Chief Antonio Guterres said this year's observation falls during a milestone year as the planet anticipates the birth of its 8 billionth inhabitant. This is an occasion to celebrate our diversity and recognize our common humanity, he said. At the same time, it is also a reminder of the shared responsibility to care for the planet, he added, and a moment to reflect on where we still fall short of our commitments to one another. The UN has released its latest report on children and armed conflict, which outlines the devastating impact various forms of conflict had on boys and girls across the world during the past year. The dangers outlined in the report include conflict escalation, military coups and takeovers, as well as protracted and new conflicts and violations of international law. The report highlights almost 24,000 verified grave violations against children in 2021. Killing and maiming were the most common, followed by the recruitment and use of children and the denial of humanitarian access. The places where most children were affected by grave violations were Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. Virginia Gamba, the UN expert on children and armed conflict, has called for intensifying action to protect boys and girls affected and ensure they are given a real chance to recover and thrive. Turning now to Sri Lanka, where the UN Secretary General has called for dialogue to ensure a smooth transition of government and to find lasting solutions to the country's economic crisis, his spokesperson said on Monday. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of protesters stormed the residences of the country's president and prime minister, both of whom had been moved to secure locations ahead of the takeovers. Media reports said President Gotabaya Rajapaksa is expected to step down this week, while Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe tweeted his resignation on Saturday, though no date for his departure has been set. The Secretary General condemns all acts of violence, the statement said. He also called for those responsible to be held accountable. Deanne Penn, UN News.
Hello. In this week's show, top stories include action at the Human Rights Council on Eritrea, Myanmar, and a push for all countries to take early action to stop violence against women and girls. In Ukraine, UN Refugee Agency Chief Filippo Grandi has been offering support to communities devastated by the Russian invasion, and we'll also hear the latest hard-hitting findings from the UN fact-finding mission in Libya. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. First, the news. While the Russian military advance in eastern Ukraine continues to escalate, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, on Thursday warned that the winter months are very likely to be extremely harsh on many millions of people affected by the war. Since the Russian invasion on the 24th of February, more than 11.5 million people have had to flee their homes in Ukraine, and some 6.3 million are internally displaced. Speaking from bomb-shattered ruins in Irpin and Bucha, near the capital Kyiv, here's UNHCR High Commissioner Filippo Grandi.
We must not forget that although we are in the middle of summer, on a warm day, winter is just round the corner. And winters in Ukraine are very harsh and severe, extremely cold. So we must do everything possible to prevent the cold of winter from becoming the next challenge for people that already have to face so much in their lives.
The UN Refugee Agency warned that people are struggling to rebuild their damaged homes, reunite with their families, and recover from the trauma of more than 4 months of war with no end in sight. They are also in urgent need of financial assistance, having lost their jobs and incomes, while the price of essentials continues to rise, along with fuel shortages. A staggering 84 million children risk missing out on getting an education between now and 2030, UN agency UNESCO warned on Thursday. According to the UN Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization, only one in six countries is on track to meet crucial development goals that include decent education for all by 2030. New data from UNESCO also shows that although countries aim to increase proficiency in reading and maths from 51% of primary school students in 2015 to 67% by 2030, 300 million youngsters will likely be left behind. On the pledge to provide secondary school, made by all 193 UN member states, the UN agency said that only one in six countries was on course to achieve this by the end of the decade. The problem is worst in sub-Saharan Africa, where only 4 in 10 youngsters will complete their secondary education, said UNESCO, insisting that COVID-19 had made the global education crisis worse by excluding so many children from class. To the Human Rights Council, where countries have continued to keep worrying developments in Eritrea, Myanmar and violence against women and girls firmly in the international spotlight. Among the resolutions passed on Thursday, the Council's 47 member states extended the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on Eritrea for another year. It comes amid numerous allegations of violations committed by Eritrean troops in Ethiopia's Tigray conflict, including the rape and killing of civilians in northern and western Tigray, the forced return of Eritrean refugees sheltering there, and the obstruction and commandeering of humanitarian aid. On Myanmar, the Council passed a resolution renewing the call for an independent investigation into reports of ongoing serious human rights violations there a year and a half after the military coup. At risk in particular in Myanmar are Rohingya Muslims and other minorities, hundreds of thousands of whom were forced to flee a military crackdown 5 years ago. Other significant resolutions passed by the Council on Thursday included the Canada-sponsored call to extend the mandate of the rights expert tasked with encouraging countries to end all violence against women and girls. After some discussion, the Council agreed to the explicit addition of girls to the resolution in recognition of the fact that, as the Netherlands maintained, gender-based violence is deeply entrenched in society and does not start only when a girl becomes a woman. The headlines there, and as we've been hearing, the Human Rights Council has been in session for the last 4 weeks. That's one more week than usual, and everyone's exhausted, I'll bet. One of the country situations that's attracted a lot of attention has been Libya. There have been protests across the divided country too in recent days. As you may have heard, people want change and a say in their future. And even if agreement on elections still hasn't been quite reached, despite a massive push in recent weeks and months, another piece of the puzzle that's crucial to a peaceful future for all Libyans is accountability for past rights abuses. And that's where the fact-finding mission on Libya comes in. It was appointed by the Human Rights Council to investigate violations, and sadly, it's found evidence of so many, including the discovery of more mass graves in Tahuna, near the capital Tripoli. To find out more, I've been speaking to one of the investigators, Tracy Robinson.
The fact-finding mission has discovered 3 sites in Tahuna, where they've already discovered 4 sites of mass graves, and these 3 sites are sites which FFM believes are probable sites of mass graves. We don't know how many. These are sites which now need to be excavated, but there have been hundreds of persons who we know have not been yet discovered, who have been disappeared.
Right, so who are these people?
These are primarily persons from Tahuna who have been victims of the conflict, particularly in the last, between 2015 and 2020, which is the subject of our report, where many, many men, for various reasons, were disappeared or murdered by the militia in that area.
So this would have been in one of potentially dozens of detention centres throughout Libya linked to the civil war after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi. And your latest report to the Human Rights Council talks of clear patterns of human rights violations. Just what kind of violations are we talking about? These are the most serious, aren't they?
They're absolutely the most serious. So we've seen, you know, in these detention centres, we haven't visited any detention centres. That's a critical part of the work of the FFM, which we haven't yet been allowed to do.
So you've spoken to witnesses?
I've spoken to many witnesses who have been in these detention centres or their families. And we've discovered horrific abuse and torture in those spaces of detention for migrants and Libyans. Many Libyans in detention without being charged, without coming before judicial authorities, in facilities which are extrajudicial.
You've spoken about the inability of the Libyan judiciary to really get a hold of what's going on in the country and across the country, despite a lot of goodwill and efforts to do so. So how can the international community try to help form some sort of cohesive judiciary to get on top of the abuses that are clearly still going on to Libyans, to migrants, refugees and asylum seekers?
Well, the first thing to do is to commend the judiciary for being one of the few unified institutions in Libya. That's very important and promising, but not enough. It's critical to have stability of all institutions in Libya. The judiciary can't stand alone. Accountability does demand a stable state on the path to transition. And so a stable judiciary which is free from threat, which has the resources to conduct the investigations, because the prosecuting authorities form part of the administration of justice, and the freedom to work across the country is critical. But it does depend on more happening in Libya.
Another feature of your report focuses on enforced disappearances and harassment of women and girls, and particularly female politicians as well. What are your latest findings there?
We have found generally a shrinking of the civic space, but we've noticed how women have been targeted for online abuse, but also suffer detention, disappearances, and murder as well in Libya. And this certainly has a chilling effect on women who are putting themselves up for political office, and for women activists who are key to the process, all the ongoing political processes in Libya.
This is since 2016, it's still going on today?
Absolutely. So we have noticed, because it was projected that there would have been elections last year in December, that there was significant political activism and work from many different quarters. And that heightened activism did generate tensions and did produce a counteracting force which sought to narrow the space available for activists.
Your report also talks about the vulnerability of children who face as many crimes as adults. So why are children being targeted?
So children are, as you mentioned, facing exactly the same violations as adults. And some of it happens, for example, in the context of migration, because children are being detained with adults and suffering exactly the same context of torture and abuse as adults. We've noticed significant sexual violations against children in Tarhuna. Children have been found in mass graves as well. Everywhere we have noted violations of adults, we've seen violations of children.
I mean, people might say that this sounds like a broken state. What would you say?
This is a state, as you've seen from Libyans' protests over the last few days, this is a state in which people are frustrated and are demanding change. This is a state which does need to move into a space of accountability, reconciliation, to be able to form a unified state which serves all Libyans.
And your hope is what from this Human Rights Council session?
Our hope is that we inform the Council about violations which were not yet known, that we reiterate findings from earlier reports, but we also hope that the Council expresses a commitment to Libya in what is going to be a long journey to transition, and the human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law, for which we are responsible for reporting, are a critical part of that transition.
On the commission of crimes against humanity, potentially, and crimes and contraventions of international humanitarian law, the fact-finding mission on Libya, of which you're a member, has started compiling a list of potential suspects. Now, what will happen to this list? Who is going to see it, and when will it be published?
So ultimately, you know, our instructions and mandate from the Council is that we must preserve the evidence. We're often asked about the list, but really it's the larger evidence of which this is a part, which is important, because all of that evidence becomes part of the custody of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and is now available based on the protocols adopted to be shared where useful for further investigations and prosecutions. So the hope is that that evidence later on serves the ends of accountability.
And is used to hopefully prevent crimes happening in future.
Absolutely. The whole idea of accountability is that accountability is essential to repairing those who have suffered, but also plays an important role in ensuring non-repetition.
My thanks then to Tracy Robinson from the Libya Fact-Finding Mission. Great to have the latest on the investigators' work and a better understanding of the situation in the country. That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be catching up with the First Nation activists who've travelled thousands of miles from Western Australia to UN Geneva to try to protect their sacred art from destruction. Hope you'll be able to join us for that. Until then, bye-bye for now. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Health Agency issued an urgent appeal on Friday for access to sick and injured people caught up in the war in Ukraine. This includes hundreds of landmine victims, premature babies, pregnant women and the elderly in eastern and southern oblasts. Speaking from Odessa and calling for humanitarian corridors to be established, here's Dr. Dorit Nitsan, Ukraine Crisis Incident Manager for the World Health Organization, WHO.
I'm sure that once there will be corridors, we will be there. So the fact that there are no corridors speaks to itself. Surely all of us asking in different fora, please let us in.
The WHO official noted that others in need of help included those with chronic but preventable illnesses, those with heart disease, cancer patients and diabetics, whose condition has worsened because they have run out of medicine. Ahead of mass protests planned in Sri Lanka over the weekend, the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, urged the authorities to show restraint and ensure every necessary effort to prevent violence. The appeal from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights follows increasing tensions linked to Sri Lanka's dire economic situation and the tremendous suffering that it has meant for ordinary citizens. There have already been reports of confrontations between individuals, police officers and the armed forces at fuel stations, where thousands of desperate members of the public have queued for hours and sometimes days, said OHCHR spokesperson Ravina Shamdasani.
The media has reported that 13 people have actually died while waiting in long queues for fuel. Now, we haven't managed to verify these reports, but there are other deaths that have also been reported of people who haven't made it to the hospital in time for, you know, illnesses that were very much treatable, but they died because of this lack of fuel, preventing them from accessing hospitals in time.
Ms. Shamdasani explained that although protesters had pelted police with stones reportedly, these had been met with tear gas, water cannon and on occasions live ammunition. Under international law, gatherings should only be dispersed in exceptional cases, with use of force a last resort where absolutely necessary and proportionate, the OHCHR spokesperson said. At the Human Rights Council in Geneva, member states urged Afghanistan's de facto authorities to reverse the many restrictions they placed on girls and women. In a resolution that was adopted without a vote on Friday, countries also expressed deep concern at the continued prevalence of violence and discrimination against women and girls in Afghanistan. Member states went on to reaffirm the equal right of every child to education in reference to the ban on girls attending secondary school in many parts of Afghanistan since the Taliban took power last August. The Council also called for the reinstatement of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission before warning about shrinking space for civil society and journalists. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
The developing countries really used all the resources to try to face the pandemic. So when this other crisis comes and hits them again, they are in a weak position. They are exhausted in economic terms.
Hello, this is the Weekly Tradecast, a new podcast brought to you by the UN Conference on Trade and Development. I'm Sarah Combs. We're exploring how major events are shaping trade and development and how that affects billions of people around the world. This week, we're talking to Rebecca Grinspan, Secretary General of UNCTAD, about the global cost of living crisis that's hitting developing countries especially hard. Rebecca Grinspan also coordinates the task team of the UN's Global Crisis Response Group, working to lessen the impact of the war in Ukraine as the costs of food and energy soar, interest rates rise and financing gets tighter. A recent UN report says at least 1.2 billion people are severely exposed to the crisis and unable to cope. Here's what she said at a press conference in New York.
The current food crisis may rapidly turn into a food catastrophe of global proportions in 2023. We remain convinced, like the Secretary General of the UN said, that there can be no effective solution to the global food crisis without reintegrating Ukraine's food production as well as the food and fertilizer produced by Russia into world markets despite the war.
So what must be done? Well, we're joined now by Rebecca Grinspan, an economist and former vice president of Costa Rica. She's the first woman to lead the UN's trade body in its 60-year history. Thank you for joining us, Secretary General. How has this cost of living crisis erupted so quickly and so acutely?
We have to be aware that prices were rising also before the war in Ukraine because of COVID-19 and the disruption of the global value chains. Now, it's interesting, Russia and Ukraine are very small in total trade in the world, but they are very important in some products that are essential. Yes, Russia in fuel and fertilizers, Ukraine and Russia in wheat, barley, sunflower oil. So the prices of those products, because of the war, started to go up very steeply, affecting a lot the countries that were importing those goods from Russia and from Ukraine. Now, these countries needed to buy from somewhere else. So you understand the chain effect. So they will go to the market, the prices will go up, and then it will affect everybody, not only those that used to import from Russia and Ukraine.
Now, why are developing countries particularly at risk?
Well, you know, we were already in a very weak position. You know, we are facing three global crises at the same time. We are facing the climate change crisis with droughts and floods in many parts of the world, hitting the most vulnerable. Then we had the COVID-19 pandemic, and the developing countries really used all the resources to try to face the pandemic, their savings, their fiscal space, their monetary policy, the safety nets to protect people from the effects of COVID-19. So when this other crisis comes and hits them again, they are in a weak position. So suddenly you are in this weak position trying to think that 2022 will be a good year, that we will recover. And the war in Ukraine comes and hits the global economy again. And, you know, the inflation problem with this cost of living crisis. So they really feel exhausted in terms of this interrelated crisis that are hitting them again and again.
Now, looking at Sri Lanka, it's already defaulted on its debt payments for the first time in its history. And it's suffering, as you said, from extreme shortages of food, medicine and fuel. Now, is this situation unique to Sri Lanka, or can we expect to see some kind of domino effect for too long with other countries following suit?
We are really worried that if we don't do something, there will be a domino effect of developing countries defaulting on their debt because the debt ratios are very high. Their ability to pay is decreasing. So Sri Lanka is not a lonely case, unfortunately. Now, we can avoid this. The international community and give the resources, the liquidity. This can be a short-term problem if the international community comes to help. But it will be a long-term problem if we don't, because defaulting in your debt has, you know, huge consequences for your growth perspective and your development perspective once it happens.
So how can you galvanize action to find a collective solution?
Well, I think that the first thing that we have to do is to raise awareness that this is happening, that this is not a joke, this is not a marginal problem. We project that at least 1.6 6-7 billion people can be affected by this cost of living crisis. So let's raise awareness. I ask for help from everybody, you know, to really tell the stories of what is happening in the countries, in their families, so the leaders of the world will rise to the challenge. The second thing is to also call for action, because despite the fact that the institutions were not designed for problems of this sort, they have instruments that they can use, and we need the political will. So my phrase is, let's help the countries help the poor and vulnerable. The international community has to do that.
Well, thank you to Rebecca Grinspan, Secretary General of UNCTAD, for being our first guest. Tune in to the weekly Tradecast for more insights on the most pressing issues around the world of trade and development. There's even more on our website, unctad.org. I'm Sarah Thomas in Geneva. Goodbye for now.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. While the Russian military advance in eastern Ukraine continues to escalate, the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, on Thursday warned that the winter months are very likely to be extremely harsh on many millions of people affected by the war. Since the Russian invasion on the 24th of February, more than 11.5 million people have had to flee their homes in Ukraine, and some 6.3 million are internally displaced. Speaking from bomb-shattered ruins in Irpin and Bucha, near the capital Kyiv, here's UNHCR High Commissioner Filippo Grandi.
We must not forget that although we are in the middle of summer, on a warm day, winter is just round the corner. And winters in Ukraine are very harsh and severe, extremely cold. So we must do everything possible to prevent the cold of winter from becoming the next challenge for people that already have to face so much in their lives.
The UN Refugee Agency warned that people are struggling to rebuild their damaged homes, reunite with their families, and recover from the trauma of more than 4 months of war with no end in sight. They are also in urgent need of financial assistance, having lost their jobs and incomes, while the price of essentials continues to rise, along with fuel shortages. A staggering 84 million children risk missing out on getting an education between now and 2030. UN agency UNESCO warned on Thursday. According to the UN Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization, only one in six countries is on track to meet crucial development goals that include decent education for all by 2030. New data from UNESCO also shows that although countries aim to increase proficiency in reading and maths from 51% of primary school students in 2015 to 67% by 2030, 300 million youngsters will likely be left behind. On the pledge to provide secondary school, made by all 193 UN member states, the UN agency said that only one in six countries was on course to achieve this by the end of the decade. The problem is worst in sub-Saharan Africa, where only 4 in 10 youngsters will complete their secondary education, said UNESCO, insisting that COVID-19 had made the global education crisis worse by excluding so many children from class. To the Human Rights Council, where countries have continued to keep worrying developments in Eritrea, Myanmar, and violence against women and girls firmly in the international spotlight. Among the resolutions passed on Thursday, the Council's 47 member states extended the mandate of the Special Rapporteur on Eritrea for another year. It comes amid numerous allegations of violations committed by Eritrean troops in Ethiopia's Tigray conflict, including the rape and killing of civilians in northern and western Tigray, the forced return of Eritrean refugees sheltering there, and the obstruction and commandeering of humanitarian aid. On Myanmar, the Council passed a resolution renewing the call for an independent investigation into reports of ongoing serious human rights violations there a year and a half after the military coup. At risk in particular in Myanmar are Rohingya Muslims and other minorities, hundreds of thousands of whom were forced to flee a military crackdown 5 years ago. Other significant resolutions passed by the Council on Thursday included the Canada-sponsored call to extend the mandate of the rights expert tasked with encouraging countries to end all violence against women and girls. After some discussion, the Council agreed to the explicit addition of girls to the resolution in recognition of the fact that, as the Netherlands maintained, gender-based violence is deeply entrenched in society and does not start only when a girl becomes a woman. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Turtles and tourism and turtles and the economy and other things are in direct competition.
Do you think she'll give up?
It depends on how desperate she is.
I think she may give up now.
She's going back towards the sea now.
Primary threat, no, is habitat loss. And that can be directly linked to climate change impacts, as well as coastal development, coastal armoring. So it is really a multidimensional threat.
I'm Connor Lennon, and you're listening to The Lid Is On from the United Nations. This episode is the last in our four-part mini-series looking at the issues facing the marine environment surrounding the Eastern Caribbean island nation of Barbados and some of the projects that are trying to redress the balance. In the last episode, we went into the water to see the successful efforts being made by an organization called Coral, which, with support from the UN, is growing coral varieties in ocean nurseries and proving that, under the right conditions, it is possible to restore the reef. Another group receiving UN backing is the Barbados Sea Turtle Project, a research and conservation organization which began in the 1980s at the University of the West Indies. It has been successful in restoring the turtle population on the island despite a host of challenges. The group has received support from the small grant program of the Global Environmental Facility, which provides finance for several initiatives implemented by the UN Development Program. In the southwest of the island, there's a place called the Boardwalk. This is an area full of restaurants and bars that come right up to the beach, a testament to the central importance of tourism to the Barbadian economy. There I met Carla Daniel, the project's field director, who talked me through the group's activities and explained why it's important to preserve sea turtles on Barbados.
Sea turtles play a very well-researched and recognized role in ecosystem maintenance and stabilization. Hawksbills in particular feed on sponge, which is in direct competition with coral for space on the reef, so they help to maintain our coral reef. And any island which depends on white sandy beaches, as well as natural wave breaks that reefs create when we are affected by extreme weather events, knows the importance of the coral reef. So hawksbill turtles were quite close to extinction. So I think it was recognized globally around the late 1990s is also when the trade in tortoise shell, which is really hawksbill shell, was banned as well. So I think there was around that time a global recognition that we could not continue on the trajectory that we were following when it comes to hawksbills, or we were going to lose the species. On the conservation side of things, we have a 24-hour hotline that we operate. This hotline operates 365 days a year. So even though the nesting season goes from the 1st of June to the 15th of November, every single day of the year we answer the hotline and we respond to hotline calls. Persons are able to call to report emergencies where adult turtles or hatchling turtles or even sick juveniles are in need of rescue, but they also call to report turtle sightings and to report tracks, and sometimes just to report things that they observe that they don't think, you know, is right. So they see certain types of activities on the beach, they may call to report those as well. In addition to the hotline, we have patrol teams that man that hotline because we get a lot of calls. During the peak nesting season, we can get, I would say, up to 15 unique calls a night, and you know, there's still only 8 hours really in a night, so it can take quite a bit. So we have an amazing team of volunteers every year, and our team is really a really good composition because we have a nice mix of young people who are still in university, we have retirees who have a bit more time, and then we have persons who are working, but they've managed to find the time between their responsibilities and between their jobs to still come out and do what I believe they think is important work. So at night, we have three teams out. So in any 24-hour period from the 1st of June to the 15th of November, we have at least 8 persons working to answer hotline calls. We standardize the patrol efforts. So we have the same team of people on that beach for 4 months every single year, and their objective is to walk the beach every hour from 7:30 p.m. to 4 a.m. in the morning, and to see and record every single turtle that comes up, so that at the end of the nesting season, we know that we've seen hopefully like 95 to 99% of the turtles that nested. And because our effort is consistent across years, then any fluctuation in the number of turtles that we're seeing is likely due to changes in the nesting population.
Carla Daniel, Field Director of the Barbados Sea Turtle Project. Shanae Nichols is one of those volunteers Carla mentioned, and she spent many nights staying up, patrolling the beaches, and looking for turtles.
Right now we are on Gulf Coast Boardwalk, and as we're currently doing, we are walking the beach to see if we see any turtle activity. We can see turtles along the south coast and the west coast, but this is an area that one of the beaches that we patrol, so we will see any activities that we have. I'm interested in conservation, and this is a way for me to be a part of it. I got interested in it through the University of the West Indies, and then from time I started, I enjoyed it. So I think it's a passion that got me going.
So you've saved lots of turtles?
Yes, yes. Even in a night, I have released more than 1,000 hatchlings.
Oh, wait, in one night?
Yes.
Wow.
In one particular area of the beach, one time we got 800 hatchlings, and we had to try to get them to a safe air beach to release them.
Barbados Sea Turtle Project volunteer Shanae Nichols. Carla Daniel explained that whilst the project has had success in bringing up the turtle numbers, they're still at risk for a host of reasons.
Primary threat now is habitat loss, and that can be directly linked to climate change impacts, as well as coastal development, coastal armoring, and so on. So it is really a multidimensional threat. The other issue that turtles face is temperature. Because sea turtles are, sea turtle hatchlings, the sex is determined by temperature, and that temperature sex determination skews toward females as the temperature increases. So there are many beaches around the world, and in Barbados as well, where they've been feminized. So these beaches are producing 100% female turtles. The skewing of the sex ratio potentially in the short term could have a positive impact, because males mate, you could say indiscriminately, so multiple males will mate with females and so on, so a proportionately smaller number of males can service a larger number of females. But of course you will get to the tipping point where as these older males die and they're not being adequately replaced in the population, then there will be females who cannot find a male to mate with, and your population will begin to contract. And then there is of course the bigger issue of hatching success periods. So it is one thing to have perhaps a skewed sex ratio, but it is another thing to have the egg simply not hatch because it is too warm. And some turtles do nest on black sand beaches on volcanic islands, and those black sand beaches are getting very hot. So there are places where hatching success of nests is below 40%. Some of that may be attributed to temperature, but there are other factors at play as well. Thankfully, in Barbados, we do still enjoy quite good hatching success. But I think where climate change factors and impacts are concerned, sea turtles, for us, could kind of be considered the canary in the mine, because they are literally on the edge of the island. They're going to feel those extreme weather events first, all their eggs, and the thing about it is that the hawksbill nesting season coincides exactly with the hurricane season. So they're laying on these ever-narrowing beaches, and whenever we get an extreme weather event, and it's not necessarily a case of a direct impact, those large waves and the swells that are generated erode the beaches. So especially if this was to happen, let's say around August, when we have the majority of eggs incubating on the shoreline, we could lose half of the eggs that are laid in the nesting season with one passing storm. One of the issues that compounds this is that beaches are narrower. So turtles generally will try to get quite high above the water, especially hawksbills. They go up to the vegetation line to lay their eggs. but on a narrow beach, they can only go so far. So often properties are bracketed by sea walls, by revetments, and so on. So when they come out of the sea, they can only get, you know, maybe 5 meters above the waves, or in some cases 3 meters or less above the waves. So it means that their eggs are not through choice, but because of the environment that they have and the current situation where the habitat is concerned, they can only lay the eggs in the space they have available. So some of the impacts we're seeing is, yes, turtles are laying eggs closer to the water. The eggs are being laid more densely, so more turtles are laying in the same area because there's fewer spaces to nest. So there's some areas where there's been significant erosion, and you may have a stretch of coastline where there's only one pocket of relatively wide dry sand. So all of the turtles that would like to nest in this general area are going to the same spot, and they're digging each other's eggs up. You also have situations where, because turtles are, you know, it's innate in them, there's no maternal care after the eggs are laid, so they're not caring for their hatchlings or anything. All of the maternal care that they give is in the nesting process. So they try their best to find the very best location, and they take their time, they dig the best possible egg chamber, and they fill it in very carefully and cover the entire area before they go back to the sea. So because these animals are so hardwired to find a good spot, it often leaves them to them straying off of the beach. So going into properties, into gardens, falling into swimming pools. We had one in that fenced-off construction site just down from where we're sitting. They cross the boardwalk to nest to get on the other side because the beach on the seaward side of the boardwalk is too narrow. We had another one night before last night that strayed into the road as well. Came up again. The beach is quite narrow. Their instincts are pushing them to go higher. You know, this is not far enough. You need to keep crawling. You need to find a better spot. And then they go off the beach and into the road.
As the bars and restaurants started to fill up, we began patrolling the boardwalk. Carla had told me that the sounds and lights would probably put off turtles from attempting to nest, but a little later we saw a large object coming out of the sea and onto the beach. So we found a turtle now, and Carla's just walking ahead. A lot of light here, so I can understand how turtles would become very distracted. Let's see what Carla says. This is a great example, isn't it, of, you know, so much light coming from this place. Must be incredibly disoriented.
I'm not sure she's going to come all the way up. You can see her sticking her head up and looking around, trying to decide if this is a good thing to do, but she is committed. They have limited energy reserves, so when they leave their foraging grounds and make that migratory trek to Barbados to nest, they use up stored reserves. So they're not eating between nests or anything like that. They are fasting. So all of the energy that they're using up when they come out of the sea, they can't get back. So if she does all of this and is unsuccessful in nesting, that's energy that's wasted. And it can have a real impact on the quality of her eggs, and the number of eggs she's able to lay. So, I mean, this is a really good example of a very narrow beach.
She's to come so near to people and the music and the lights.
Yeah, but she's going to want to come up higher as well, so there's a good chance. Shanae, don't... she's trying to move the people, sorry. She's trying to move the people from standing directly in front of the turtle.
Why do you need to...
Because she's not settled, so it's going to ask you to stay right still as well. She is still trying to make up her mind. And if she's startled by somebody walking past right in front of her, or even maybe using flash photography or anything like that at this point, she may get scared enough that she'll just turn around and go straight back into the sea.
She's climbing up now.
Yeah.
So you said she's trying to get up to the highest point.
Well, not necessarily the highest point, but they kind of have an internal barometer that kind of tells them when they've gone far enough. She's now body pitting, so she is using her front and back flippers to push the sand away from her body. Essentially what she's doing is moving away the loose dry sand so that when she starts to use her back flippers to dig the egg chamber, she's digging down into damper sand that is more likely to hold the shape of the nest. Loose, dry sand will collapse, so in the long run it helps to save a little bit of time.
So she started and then stopped and moved on.
She wasn't
very
happy.
Didn't fancy it. Okay,
yeah,
she's moving towards us now.
So yeah, we're going to have to keep very still. But of course, because it's the boardwalk and because people are just...
Well, whilst you've been talking, we've seen a big crowd start to gather.
Yeah, and these people are just walking by. There's a pretty good chance that she is just going to give up. And excuse me. Hello? Yeah, do you mind not moving around? Just stay very still, please. It's so difficult. And what's more remarkable is that there was no beach here. So until this boardwalk was built, this is not a place that turtles used to come and nest. We created this beach essentially out of nothing, and it is not good quality. There's a lot of activity.
So when you say it's crazy, what was it before?
The water came up to the walls and to the rocks. There was no sand. So the headlands, etc., essentially caused the beach to form, but they're very narrow, kind of unstable beaches. So they are they're not great for nesting. But because they're here, turtles are coming. So really, if these beaches didn't exist, there's a chance this turtle would have come up on another better quality beach.
But she's right next to us now, and she started digging
down
a bit.
Stop pointing, thank you. She's still body fitting. She's moving.
Okay, so even that movement, she wouldn't like that.
She's facing you. You don't want to.
Okay.
To disturb. She's turning around. No, I think she's kind of uncomfortable with all the.
You think she'll go? Okay,
this
so now.
This guy just walked past, and she flinched and turned almost 180 degrees.
Do you think she'll give up?
It depends on how desperate she is. I think she may give up. No.
She's going back towards the sea now.
I kind of prefer it when they turn around and face away, because at least then they're not seeing all of the movement and all of the behind them. They're just obviously quite desperate. She's looking around some more.
And if she's not able to nest them now, what are her options?
The second set of eggs that she's going to lay after this one is already developing. And there's about a 14-day window. Once the clutch she has now is ready to be laid, there's about a 14-day window to get them laid, to get those eggs laid. And she has to lay them before the second set is ready. So if she's not able to do so, then in a worst-case scenario, she will have to release them. So turtles have been documented releasing eggs into the sea. And of course, they're dead instantly because they can't go into the water. These people just moved and she flinched a little bit again. I mean, it's really interesting because people will take 10 pictures and then they'll move again to take the same 10 pictures. But you can
someone
see
from the sticking. Someone from the restaurant there just giving some more instructions to tourists.
Yeah. She facing away again. She's just been kind of turning in circles and trying and moving on. She just really doesn't want to give up. But so she... She is heading back to the sea to go.
She's going back in.
Yeah. It is too bad because, you know, this is all wasted time, wasted energy. But on the other hand, I'm kind of hopeful that she will come up the second time around at a better location where the beach is a bit wider and there are fewer people and less lights, and the hatchlings will have a better chance.
A sad end to the turtle's attempt to lay her eggs on a narrow beach on the boardwalk, and a stark example of the tension between the development of Barbados and the ability of the turtle population to thrive. There are no easy answers, but Carla told me that there needs to be a way for people and turtles to coexist.
One solution somebody might say is, we need to barricade the beaches and stop the turtles from getting into the road. In one way, that is a solution because it means that they're less vulnerable to being struck by vehicles. But it is not a solution for the problem, which is pushing them onto the roads, which is inadequate nesting space. The other thing that we think is really important is physical exclusion. So you have inadequate nesting space where the beach is narrow or the beach is gone, and they're just not able to nest there. But then you also have factors where you have space that is quite wide. You know, there are still some quite good beaches. Barbados still has some gorgeous beaches, but turtles and tourism and turtles and the economy and other things are in direct competition. So how we manage that space and how we use it will either allow those turtles to utilize the space as well, or it will physically exclude them from the space. And it can be really simple. Something like leaving beach chairs out all night long on the beach can mean that when turtles come up to nest, the beach is covered with chairs and they just can't find the space, or they can't access the space to lay their eggs. And not only is it excluding them, but it creates a hazard because they are tenacious, so they will still try, and then they get trapped in the beach chairs, or potentially they may even drag, get stuck, but because the chairs are light, they're able to drag them with them to the sea, and then they potentially drown. So I think a lot of it is, of course, attempting to mitigate climate change, doing what we can to preserve the beaches that we have left, and in some cases to rehabilitate some of the beaches that have been lost or that we are losing, but also to maybe take another look at how we utilize those spaces and try to do so in a way that makes space, of course, for tourists and for commerce, but also for these endangered animals that need the beach to survive.
Carla Daniel, Field Director for the Barbados Sea Turtle Project, which, against the odds, is successfully restoring the turtle population on the island. This has been the last of our four episodes from Barbados, highlighting the ocean-related challenges facing the island and the way the government, civil society, and the UN are finding ways to fight back and promote sustainable development. This mini-series was produced to coincide with the 2022 UN Ocean Conference, convened to bring fresh impetus to science-based solutions and start a new chapter of global ocean action. You'll find a host of videos and text stories about the conference, as well as more episodes of The Lid Is On our website, news.un.org.